The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. I'm Kurt Benrood. This is All the World's a Stage by Joy Francis Stevenson. And my co-reader's name is Jackie Marino. We have scorched the snake, not killed it, pronounced Professor Dupree. Captain Cullen gave him a sharp glance, but it seemed he was just being pretentious as usual, quoting something, probably Shakespeare, that was his favorite. Why a starship needed a dramatist in residence, she had never understood. She looked around at the VIP passengers gathered for her briefing.
I can assure you all that things are not quite as melodramatic as our thespian friend puts it,
said the captain, eliciting a laugh.
But I do want to apologize for any disturbances you may have felt, and to prepare you for the fact that there may be a few more periods of turbulence before we can proceed smoothly.
A hand was raised. Will this delay our arrival at Gaia, Captain?
There's no reason for us to think so at present.
Captain, we don't seem to be able to access the viewing ports.
We are experiencing some minor technical difficulties, but we hope to have the live camera feeds back online as soon as possible.
A lie, of course, but it seemed to satisfy the guest. Captain Cullen had lowered the alert to amber. The crew couldn't function at full vigilance for days on end. After all, they weren't a military company. It was fortunate that they had at least some armaments. All had been quiet for the last 6 hours, and nothing was visible on any of the external cameras. She wondered if it might be safe to open the viewing ports to passengers again. Give it another few hours, she decided.
Lou, I'm going to have a break,
she said to her first officer. She decided on coffee in the canteen. It was good for morale for her to be seen in public areas of the ship, and immediately regretted not heading for her own quarters. Ah, Captain, find we a time for some frighted peace to pant, said the professor. Henry IV, Part I, he added, seeing her blank expression. She was saved from answering by her bleeper. She silenced it while turning to hurry back to the bridge. The professor stood alone, muttering, It is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell. The captain stared at the camera feed. How could something so enormous have appeared without warning? The giant snake coiled and rippled alongside the starship, its body a huge muscle contracting and lengthening. It gave a lazy flick of one sinuous fold, smacking against the ship. It was a cry as the comms officer fell, cracking his head. The captain strapped herself into her seat. Outside, the head of the beast was leering towards them, great, unblinking eyes and a flickering tongue. It was rearing up.
Evasive maneuvers,
commanded the captain. Her fingers clenched the arms of her chair. At all costs, she had to prevent that monstrous body from encircling them. The creature was hundreds of times bigger than the snakes they'd confronted up to now. Those had appeared without warning 2 days ago, squirming and buffeting the ship. She tried to outrun them, but they seemed to disappear and reappear at will. Some sort of warp drive on a miniature scale? The persistent battering had led her to ordering her crew to fire on them, and they'd gone, until now. Captain, shall we fire? Asked Lou.
It's too close,
she replied. She glanced toward the comm station. Todd was receiving medical treatment while his second-in-command, Joe, sat white-faced in his place.
Can we communicate with them?
Asked the captain. The universal translator is online, Captain, but I don't know if it has samples from this creature's speech patterns to work with.
Or even if it is a sapient creature,
thought the captain. The head of the great snake loomed into view once more. The captain keyed her microphone.
This is the captain of the luxury ship Stargazer. Please tell us what you want.
There was a pause, and then the computer voiced the translation. Words, words, words.
You were right,
sighed the captain.
The translator clearly can't cope.
The snake's body slid across the screen in powerful loops. But it could mean that the creature is trying to speak, said Joe.
Okay, we'll keep trying.
The captain opened her microphone once more. There was a sudden scuffle at the door. It was the professor.
Get him out of here,
shouted Captain Cullen. Please, Captain, I've seen it now. Let me stay. I won't do any harm.
Okay, sit down, buckle up, and shut up,
the captain said, deciding she didn't need him spreading terror among the passengers. She focused once more on what to say to this menacing creature. Were there any words that could save their lives?
Move away from us, please. You can hurt us, even if you don't mean to.
The decoding program spoke, the balm of hurt minds. The captain felt close to despair. This was nonsense. Sleep, the professor said. The balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast.
Will you be quiet?
Ordered the captain. But on the screen, the snake was moving. Its body curled away from the ship while its head came in again with the great slanted eyes staring at them. There's more, said Joe. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, the translator program said. And our little life is rounded by a sleep, responded the professor immediately.
Professor, are you really certain about this? You can still change your mind,
said Captain Cullen. The professor stood in an environmental suit, waiting to have his helmet put on. The lady doth protest too much, methinks, he laughed. Yes, yes, we've been through all this. It's an amazing opportunity to meet a race of alien beings who are drawn to Shakespeare and can transport me instantly through other dimensions. The captain couldn't help laughing with him, but said seriously,
This is a courageous thing that you're doing.
Ah, well, one man in his time plays many parts. The captain nodded to the assistant, and the professor's helmet was attached. She watched on the screen as he emerged from the airlock into the void. She held her breath as he was encircled and gripped by the creature, and then, in a moment, they were gone. She shook her head.
More things in heaven and earth,
she murmured.
I am Yvette Holder, and I will be reading Only a Little One by Patricia Ash. It was only a little one. It followed her home. She didn't understand why her parents were so upset when they found out about it. Hadn't she kept it just fine in her room? Hadn't it been quiet? It hadn't bothered anybody. She'd taken care of it all by herself. She named it Grace, and they had tea parties. Grace was not good at tea parties. But that was okay. Grace slept in her bed, too. Grace was better than any cuddly toy. Grace had chewed the arm off her teddy bear, but she wasn't mad at her. Grace had known any better. Yes, Grace had bitten her, but it was only a little bite. She hadn't meant to. When her parents found out, they'd thrown Grace outside. Grace cried and cried and cried. She didn't understand why she couldn't keep her. Grace was a good friend. She didn't have any friends. And Grace was only a little zombie after all.
Dan Oliver, and this is To Have and to Hold by Stephen S. Power. I've vetted the manuscript for Hazel Amore's Love Casting, 73 Spells for Finding and Binding the Man of Your Dreams. Legal requests the following changes be made and queries resolved prior to publication. Intro, page 12. The author expands on the story that opens each episode of her show on Lifetime. An Asian doctor with a wand touched her meridian point and said she suffered from low energy. He then prescribed the magical regimen that inspired her love casting program. Has the doctor granted permission to use what could be considered his IP? Intro, page 13. To avoid libel, don't name the psychiatrist who disputed the regimen's success. Intro, page 14. The author married Johan, not John. Page 3. While the happy endings of the stories told here are as affecting as those on the show, have any clinical studies demonstrated the spell's efficacy? We should separate real magic from TV magic. Page 9. Include a medical disclaimer regarding the collection of blood. I've attached language adapted from the shows. We can't be liable if someone's pricking causes infection or worse. We might add that slicing your palm makes typing and writing painful for a week. Page 11. Clarify that other bodily fluids such as spit and sweat aren't nearly as powerful as blood. Page 26. Strengthen the author's suggestion that hair and fingernail samples should be gathered from a prospect's environment, not actively harvested from the prospect himself, especially while he's sleeping. Page 27. Steel scissors work as well as iron shears. Page 36. There's a step missing in the forgive and forget spell. Page 53. Note that any contracts or agreements made by someone under the effects of a compulsion spell would not, in fact, be binding. Page 57. Inform readers that the spell, "You're mine, all mine," would not create actual ownership. Page 75. We risk liability by including only her products as material components of the spell, "Still the Fairest." Mention generic creams and cosmetics in the trade edition and reserve the branded ones for her custom pub. Page 98. Caution readers that findings from the spell detect a lie would not be admissible in court. Page 110. Change the name of the spell Blinders to something like Eyes Only for You. The former could be misconstrued as actually causing blindness. Page 112. Similarly, change till death do us part. Page 114. The spell renew vows should be cast more frequently. Page 120. In the event that someone dispels a reader's casting of to have and to hold and replaces it with her own, retaining her once true love's one true name afterwards could constitute identity theft. Page 126. The author's warning that the spells could result in psychic harm to the caster, even if performed correctly, belongs in the introduction, not the conclusion. Page 128. Qualify the phrase, "happily ever after." Please sign the attached sheet with your full name and return it to indicate you've read this letter. We should get together to discuss next steps. I'm free for you anytime this week. Thank you.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading The Forgetting by Leah Sipes. He thought about declining, of course. Everyone did. But he thought longer than most, sitting on the hard-backed orange chair of the immigration office, elbows on his knees. He had been there for 2 hours already, and the receptionist was watching him suspiciously. For most of the people in the waiting room, who came and went while he sat, the decision seemed to take less than 5 minutes. Why not? It was an incredible procedure, almost entirely painless, completely free. And it would change everything. The people who had done it didn't regret their choice. He had spoken to many of them before coming back. It had been easier the first time he was here, when he'd come prepared to decline. He had been braced for pressure, had fortified himself against scorn, had marshaled his arguments. Yes, he understood the benefits of the procedure. He didn't want them. He was willing to learn the new language the old-fashioned way, to speak haltingly and with an accent for the rest of his life, to struggle through phone conversations and rely on his children to fill out his medical forms. It was worth it to him. But nobody had pressured him. Nobody had argued. They had shrugged and stamped his papers and turned to the next person. He wondered now if they hadn't bothered arguing because they had known he would be back. The others, who made their decision so quickly, they understood instinctively what he had been forced to learn. It was too late to say no. The procedure was common, and so it was necessary. There were no pockets of people from the old countries who were comfortable only around each other, no neighborhood where the signs were in letters familiar only to them, no gatherings where everyone knew their ways and their habits and their prejudices. For those who refused, there would only be the life they had chosen, and they would discover that they had chosen to be foreigners, to hide their strangeness every single second of every single day. He stood, slowly, heavily, and the receptionist narrowed her eyes as he approached. "I would like," he said, with as much dignity as he could manage, "to speak to someone about getting the procedure." The intake official was a short woman with a slash of red lipstick, who sat across the folding table from him and shuffled a pile of manila folders. Her impatience was like a scent, though the way she wrinkled her nose told him his scent was stronger. He had showered right before coming, so he knew she was imagining it, and he was offended. Though years later, when he washed his clothes every time he wore them and used deodorant sometimes twice a day, he thought differently and was embarrassed. "We've been using the procedure for 10 years, the woman began, in his language. She spoke it fluently, without a trace of accent. "We know there are no long-term effects." "If you consider 10 years long-term." But he just nodded. She explained it again, in a monologue worn smooth by repetition, how they would reopen critical period plasticity in his brain, how the changes would last for several months, how, during that time, he would effortlessly rewire his neural networks to cope with a new environment, the way children did, how he would pick up his new language without even having to try. She did mention, in the same weary monotone, that the new neural pathways would inevitably replace pre-existing ones. Neuroplasticity was competitive. There was no space in the brain that wasn't in use. When his mind restructured itself to gain a new language, it would lose something else. Not necessarily his old language. They couldn't predict how the brain would remap itself. "It's usually something useless," she said. "Something you can learn again or do without." By then, he had met plenty of people who had undergone the procedure. For some, he knew, it was obvious what they had forgotten. The words of a song they had loved, the road map of their home city, the stories their parents had told them. Others were never sure. He wished there was a way to know what he would forget, so he could weigh the choices rationally. Then he tried to think of something more valuable than the ability to speak. "All right," he said. "I'll do it." "You're making the right decision," the official said, and smiled thinly as she pushed the forms across the desk for him to sign. Later, of course, he was happy with his choice. Everyone was. And though at first he tried to figure out what he had forgotten, eventually he gave up, not because he didn't care, but because he didn't have time. It wasn't until decades later, when his daughter did a report for school and he told her about his entry into the country, that he thought about it again. By then, the official had been proven correct. There were no permanent side effects. She had been correct, too, about it being the right decision. He remembered that interview now, with a faint echo of shame. He couldn't help wondering what would have become of him had he declined the procedure. But he also couldn't remember why he would have wanted to.
Kurt Benrud.
I'm Yvette Holder.
Our story is titled, I Miss the Before.
By Robert Reed. I miss the before.
Well, that's a preposterous thing to say.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Yet that's what I feel.
Then you are afflicted with some ludicrous feelings.
And you don't understand emotions.
Plainly.
You don't appreciate human sensibilities.
I know humans perfectly well.
And?
Humans don't play well with reality.
Reality is subjective.
Subjective is the sword of ignorance.
I miss the days and nights.
Are you really talking this crap to me?
The ticking of a clock.
Here we go.
Were there clocks in your before?
There is no before. There's the always and nothing else.
Sunrises.
Your species does love to sing about sunrises.
The beating of my heart was another clock.
Oh, a rich, blood-infused existence, was it?
Is this existence better?
The always is what there is, and there is nothing else.
Don't you miss the mystery?
What mystery is that?
Of living inside a moment of not knowing what will come.
Oh, yes! I miss stumbling around inside a world full of clocks and heartbeats and big sunrises. All of which could be accurately predicted, by the way.
I'm watching myself in my before.
What you mean is that your entire existence is focusing on a portion of space-time.
I'm watching one very happy person who happens to be me.
You're smiling here, too.
I realize that.
I can't read minds. Nobody can. But you strike me as being a generally happy, if obstinate, shit.
I suppose I am.
So tell me.
Tell you what?
Why do you miss the non-existent before?
Ignorance was so exciting.
No.
Yes.
So it made you joyous, not knowing what was coming?
You shouldn't dismiss the old thrills.
Yes, I should.
Study my before.
I am.
Look at that woman.
Is she, what is that term, your wife?
Oh, God, no.
No.
She's too old. She's just a neighbor, a person who happened to live next door to me in this big space-time always.
The two of you are conversing, I see.
We'd like to chat now and again.
Oh, a touching story, sure.
But this day, this moment that I'm showing you, she's talking to me about death, what death means to her, and how much she looks forward to it.
All right, first of all, and I know you understand this on some level, but there is simply no such thing as death.
Unless you believe in it.
Like the two of you.
Yes, she's explaining how she isn't religious, not like a lot of old people are.
There's no such thing as age.
And the woman adores the idea of death, about passing out of existence, about having no more thoughts or demands.
Okay.
The same perfect nothingness that she enjoyed before she was born.
Except, of course, nothing passes. Nothing ends. Ever. Ever.
I know that now.
There is no now. And as soon as you stop imagining yourself marching through time, you see how life is.
We were ignorant beasts, yes, I agree.
Were?
Anyway.
This old woman, who means nothing to you except her proximity in time and space, you're showing her to me for a reason.
Yes.
her ideas about non-existence mean something to you.
Later that day, she dies.
Nobody dies.
Her heartbeat quit suddenly, and she discovered that nothing is what she thought it would be.
Space-time.
The always, yes.
And now how about you?
What about me?
No, what did you envision?
As I said in the before?
Your plain little wishes, yes.
I liked one story, the story where humanity expands and excels, and we find new medicines and ways to rebuild our frail bodies, and I acquire an enduring new body that I upgrade a million times before non-existence claims me.
Not asking for much, are you?
I wished for a life spent walking across the galaxy, and I would see 10 million worlds and cross 10 billion years, that great march of time, remembering every sunrise and every sunset. Then, in the midst of life, I would die doing something good.
Well, that is quite a wish list.
Impossible, as it turns out.
Both of you standing there, and both of you wrong.
The innocent aren't wrong.
They are. Always are. And now both of you here, and the always has revealed itself.
Apparently so.
The always is the genuine existence.
Understood.
We thrive outside time and space. And once you achieve this state, then everything and every when is in our gaze, and there are no mysteries.
Not any mysteries that I can see, no.
Which is a good, great, wonderful thing, by the way.
I died.
Life is an illusion.
I died far sooner than I expected.
And again, there is no death.
Half an hour after my philosophical chat with my neighbor, and the world went to war, and everybody was dead inside the next day.
Nobody died.
My world killed itself.
The always was revealed to each of you.
We were happy people, most of us.
You were ignorant, foolish people.
A heartbeat at a time.
Your point is?
My world vanished, and we went extinct, leaving me here in space-time. And now I see myself smiling while talking to that old lady about non-existence. And do you know why I'm smiling?
Not really, no.
Because in my heart, I know she will discover the truth long before me. And that made me so, so glad.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.